turning to Jonathan Privet Mendoza now, who is, I think it's wonderful, a master's student from University of York, so it's great that Jonathan is presenting to us. And I guess we're going to go a bit further back in time. Yes.
Yeah.
So have we got Jonathan's PowerPoint up? Great. Over to you.
Okay. Hello, and thank you all so much for coming and for the wonderful first day of the workshop yesterday. I especially want to thank Dr. Rubina for having me and for the host of this event and this collaboration between St. Anthony's College and Museum Pahang. Today I will be presenting my research piecing together the early history of Pahang through Imperial Chinese scripture, which in many ways harkens back to some of the presentations in yesterday's panels. I specifically want to acknowledge the wonderful introduction to the topic of Pahang's wealth of resources covered in Her Royal Majesty the Queen's opening lecture yesterday. So, the histories of Pahang and other modern Malaysian polities have often been framed through a Eurocentric lens. This perspective is rooted in a European essentialist view of the planet, has contributed to a portrayal of Asia, particularly Southeast Asia, as a stagnant entity. The long and rich history of Pahang has traditionally been depicted using broad strokes, which has obscured the finer details that are critical to understanding the region's historical dynamics. Today, I seek to apply a microhistorical lens to Pahang's pre-modern past, focusing specifically on the availability and exploitation of resources. By utilizing Imperial Chinese documents, this investigation seeks to not only illuminate the complexities of Pahang's history, but also encourage further scholarly engagement with the region. In doing so, I hope to contribute to a more comprehensive of Pahang's role within the broader historical narrative of Southeast Asia, challenging the entrenched Eurocentric perspectives and highlighting the region's rich and dynamic past. These are the Imperial Chinese texts I will mainly be focusing on. One of the earliest references to Pahang in Imperial Chinese texts is the Zhu Fan Zhi, completed in 1226 by Zhao Ruquo during the Song Dynasty, in which Pahang is called Feng Hong. The Daoyi Zhiyue, authored by Wang Dayuan in the 1330s during the Yuan Dynasty, documents the trade between Chinese ports in Southeast Asia along the Maritime Silk Road. In this document, Pahang is referenced to Panhang. The Taiping Yulan is a Song Dynasty encyclopedic work compiled under Emperor Taizong between 977 and 983. In which Pahang is referenced in The Four Barbarians, Part 8, Southern Barbarians, Chapter 3, as Po Huang. Fei Xin's Xingcha Shenglang, published in 1436, is a sailor's account of maritime trade and exploration detailing the travels across the seas to Southeast Asia and beyond under Admiral Zhang He. In this text, Pankan is used to refer to Pahang. And finally, the Mingshi is the final volume in the 24 Histories of Chinese Historical Text, compiled during the Qing Dynasty. It chronicles the history of the Ming Dynasty, and Panheng is again used to refer to Pahang in the Mingshi. Some indirect sources that I use are the Pingzhou Ketan, which was authored in the year 1116 by Zhu Yu during the latter part of the Northern Song Dynasty, and the Bencao Gangmu, which is also known as the Compendium of Materia Medica. It's a comprehensive medical text written by Li Shizhen during the Ming Dynasty in the 16th century. Natural resources such as aromatic woods and incense dominate materials traded from Pahang across multiple Tang, Song, and Yuan Imperial Chinese texts. The Zhu Fan Zhi contains what may be the earliest mentions of the trade of Jiang Zhen Xiang, or Kayu Laka, which is laka wood, a product exclusive to the Malay world. The Zhu Fan Zhi directly mentions Pahang as an exporter of laka wood, or jianzhen xiang. Pahang's export of laka wood occurs at least by 1226, when using the dating of the Zhu Fan Zhi. Though Zhao writes of the widespread use and comprehensive knowledge of laka wood as incense in the coastal southern Song provinces of Fujian, Guangdong, and Guangxi, indicating that laka wood has been a foreign commodity present in the region prior to the Song period. Zhao provides a physical description of laka wood in his Zhu Fan Zhi, in which the export is described as vine-like with a purple color, and he notes Zicheng Xiang as another name for the products of laka wood. The term Jiangzhen is later used to describe a distinct product from Jiang Zhenxiang in the Daoyi Zhiyue, a century after the Zhu Fangzhi. In this text, Wang Dayuan denotes that Pahang now exported Jiang Zhen instead of Jiang Zhenxiang. Jiang Zhen drops the Xiang suffix and is classified as a separate product, and there are several possibilities as to the use of this product. Xiang as a suffix indicates aromatic products such as incense, and as the Yuan dynasty source omits the character, it was likely an unprocessed lacquerwood export or lacquerwood used for dye, carving, or carpentry. The Xingcha Shenglan and the Mingshi, in their entries on Pahang, translated by Grunfeld, state the use of fragrant wood to carve images of spirits, demons, and man. In the Xingcha Shenglan, he translates, they are very superstitious regarding demons and spirits making their images of fragrant wood. And in the Mingshi, he translates, they make human images of fragrant wood. Historian Dara Kang suggests that Jiang Zhen may have been used to refer to a black hardwood, citing the 16th century Portuguese chronicle Suma Oriental by Tome Perez, references to the export of black woods from the Malay Peninsula to Chinese ports. He states that black wood by European writers was used as a blanket term for tropical hardwoods that range from dark red and purple dark hues in color. Another product that may have been exported under the name Jiang Zhen could have been wood used for dye, textile creation. Work undertaken by historian Jan Wissenen Christie on textiles found the term laka being repeatedly used in medieval Javanese literature to describe certain hues of red dyes on cloth. And Fei Xin writes in the Xingcha Shenglan that Pahang produces a type of wood used for dyeing. Here you can see a species sample of Dalbergia parviflora, which is what I am choosing as the best candidate for laca wood in historical sources. The many uses of the products exported from Pahang known as laca wood give rise to the issue of determining what material laca wood was. The Chinese naming convention of products largely depends on the physical characteristics. Thus, Jiang Zhen and Jiang Shen Xiang, used as terms, may have been used to refer to not just a species of wood, but a category. Zhao's description of the physical appearance of Jiang Zhen Xiang, when combined with the product's prominence in Pahang, as well as Zhao's use of Xiang in the material described, would be the Liana species of Dalbergia parviflora. The appearance of parviflora matches the description of slender vine-like branches and red-purple wood, along with Zicheng Xiang, which is purple wood fragrance, and the character Teng means vine, matching Zhao's description that Dalbergia parviflora would be the most likely species. Further, strips of rough-cut lengths of laca wood were found in a shipwreck alongside other fragrant woods used for incense, such as sandalwood and garwood, indicating that this was the Jiang Zhen Xiang product. The use of Jiang Zhen as hardwood would disqualify Dalbergia parviflora as the species is vine-like and would be unsuitable for carpentry. Though, due to the naming convention used by the Chinese traders, Jiang Zhen would be able to be identified as a different species. For this, I suggest Endentera pavonina, or false red sandalwood, which would be a very likely candidate for Jiang Zhen, as tropical hardwoods such as sandalwoods and rosewoods were in high demand by Chinese traders between the late Song and Yuan dynasties. The timber of Endentera pavonina has a comparable dark red hue to that of Dalbergia parviflora and shares a similar scent of fresh wood. This wood is also utilized for making red dyes, which may have caused Song and Yuan merchants to assume that these look-alike goods originated from the same tree, particularly with the heartwood being crafted into Jiang Zhen Xiang and the remaining wood being Jiang Zhen. Pahang is posited by previous historians such as William Lyman to have been Muen, or a vassal or tributary state to Langkasuka and later Shubhajaya, allowing for the possibility of Pahang exports to be classified as Srivijayan exports in the early and late Northern Song texts due to vassal status or due to Pahang's goods passing through Srivijaya. Though Srivijaya is noted to be a particularly desolate country in terms of their own exports. So the sandalwood and frankincense, which are not endemic species to Pahang, they would instead be imported into Pahang and later exported out to China again. Here I have a map that I created of mineral resources in Pahang, collated through mineral surveys in the region. The yellow dots represent significant gold deposits, with gray representing tin and blue representing iron. The singular dark gray is cassiterite or tin oxide, which is used in the production of tin. In 1936, William Lyman claimed that the region's name, Pahang, was derived from a Khmer word for tin, though he posits this due to tin mining in the region dating to prehistoric times at the Sungai Lembing mines, though sociologist Jeffrey Benjamin offers what may be more plausible to the region's name, being that Majapahit and other Primalakan sources applied the name Pahang to the whole of the southern part of the peninsula. While the origins of the namesake remain controversial, the region's association with tin cannot be denied and can be further explored through Imperial Chinese text. Fei Xin writes of tin being one of Pahang's major exports in the Xingcha Shenlan, mentioning tin as a product of the region consistent with the resource distribution of known tin deposits in Pahang. Major deposits are concentrated in Huantuan and Pekan, with outliers being a major tin deposit in Lipis and cassiterite in Bantong. The historical writing regarding the peninsula often highlights the significance of tin from the west coast, rarely acknowledging the reserves found in Pahang and the peninsula's east coast, with only a handful of scholars like Jacques Pergolac addressing the tin deposits located in the east and west regions of the peninsula. This is despite Sungai Lembing once being the largest mine in Malaysia with over 50 veins of ore. The Malay Peninsula has also been associated with a wealth of gold since the 2nd century CE, in which it was dubbed the Golden Chersonese, in Ptolemy's Geographia. The prominence of gold resources in the peninsula continuously expanded upon through numerous explorers, writers, and nations taking note of Malay gold production. Pahang possesses a majority of the identified gold deposits in Malaysia. The state has 6 out of the 9 significant gold deposits in peninsular Malaysia, with surveys showing that principal gold deposits run sideways in a strip that runs along the southern part of the peninsula from the region of Patani to Malacca. Many of these deposits reside inland, though these gold fields would be accessible by medium-sized vessels through the rivers in Pahang. Some historians, such as Bennett Bronson, have discounted this possibility due to technological and economic development away from the coast being unlikely, though these claims are unconvincing due to textual evidence originated from Chinese sources, which are able to paint a picture of gold availability and use in Pahang. Specifically in the Mingxi, it's translated that in the year 1378, the king Maharaja Tajau sent envoys with a letter written on a gold leaf and bringing as tribute 6 foreign slaves and products of the country. They were received according to the established rules. Later in the Mingxi, it's also written that the people of Pahang have gold mountains, and these mountains coincide geographically with the interior of Pahang. In the valleys and the eastern foothills of the mountain range in the Rau district, which was known as the gold capital of Malaysia, though Rau was not completely exploited until the modern period, it was likely very much used for gold harvesting in pre-modern times. The examination and analysis of Chinese imperial sources and reveal a wealth of significant insights that contribute greatly to our understanding of the complex history surrounding the abundant sources and foreign trade of Pahang. Pahang's pre-modern productivity is highlighted through these accounts, elucidating the state's historical relevance in the wider economic context. While these texts provide a foundational framework for comprehending the historical development of Pahang as a significant trading hub, it is important to recognize that there exist nuances in the accuracy and reliability of the authors during this period due to many of them referencing each other. Though certain aspects, these complex relationships of these narratives still ultimately show the rich and varied resources of Pahang and empower us to construct a detailed and nuanced trade and economic microhistory illustrating the intricate interplay between local production practices and the broader regional trade networks, underscoring the notable significance of Pahang in the context of regional commerce during the pre-modern era and highlighting its pivotal role in facilitating trade across the region. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Really excellent presentation and kept time as well. I find that absolutely fascinating. Brilliant use of text, if I may say, and what a remarkable story of the long-term resource exploitation of Pahang, and actually fitting in with Rudolph's paper as well, the non-marginality, if you like, the importance of Pahang in that wider intra-Asian trading realm.